Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI, so today we're diving into a really major work, Günter Grass's The Tin Drum, or Diebleck Trommel, from 1959. And this book, it's just immense.
Oh, absolutely. It's his debut novel, incredibly, and it really sets the stage for his entire career, you know, grappling with Germany's past. He won the Nobel for a reason.
Exactly. And that grappling has a name, right? Vergangenheit Bewältigung.
Yeah.
This massive, essential struggle for Germany to confront its Nazi history.
Mm-hmm. And it's the absolute core of the Tin Drum. You can feel it on every page. Plus, there's Grass's own story layered on top.
You mean his admission much later in life about serving in the Waffen-SS?
Yes, as a teenager. It adds this incredibly complex, difficult layer to how we read his work on guilt, on complicity. It's controversial, sure, but it makes his exploration feel even more urgent somehow.
It really does. It suggests this isn't just about pointing fingers. It's this deep, almost agonizing look inward. How did ordinary people get swept up in something so grotesque?
And Grass knew that simple realism just wouldn't cut it. It couldn't capture the sheer madness and absurdity of the time.
So instead, he gives us this wild mix. It's magical realism, sharp satire, and sometimes, honestly, it's pretty hard to stomach. The grotesque is turned way up.
Definitely. And leading us through this chaos is Oscar Matzerath, our narrator. We meet him in a mental hospital in the 1950s, looking back, writing it all down.
And the premise is just unforgettable. Oscar decides, consciously on his third birthday back in 1927, that he's done growing. Physically, anyway.
Right. It literally stops. So you have this adult mind, this witness to history, trapped inside the body of a three-year-old boy. It's an incredible device.
So our task today, really, is to follow Oscar's journey. It's like a Bildungsroman, a coming-of-age story, but completely warped because he refuses to come of age in the usual sense.
Mm-hmm.
And this sets up the big question Grass throws at us, at you listening. Is Oscar's refusal to join the adult world, this crazy world, a form of protest? Is it resistance?
Or is it just another way of being complicit? By stepping aside, by choosing not to engage.
Exactly. That's the tension.
And that tension starts, well, even before Oscar's actually born. If we look at book one, setting the scene in pre-war Danzig.
Tell us about that beginning. It's quite something.
It really is. Oscar traces his origins back to his mother, Agnes, being conceived under these four wide, billowing skirts in a potato field. It's very earthy, almost mythical.
And that sets the scene for Danzig itself.
Perfectly. The free city of Danzig caught between Germany and Poland, a real mix of cultures, languages, loyalties. It's like a pressure cooker of all the tensions that are about to explode across Europe, a microcosm.
Okay, so that's the world Oscar is born into. And then comes the third birthday, 1927. He sees the adult world.
And he rejects it. All the hypocrisy, the compromises, the small lies. He just says no.
How does he do that, practically?
Well, he demands a tin drum. That's key. And when they try to take it, he engineers this fall down the cellar stairs. Very dramatic.
A fall that conveniently stops him from growing.
Exactly. He uses it as the reason. And from that point on, he stays 3 years old, physically. But he gains two things.
The drum.
Which he uses to drum up memories, stir chaos, communicate things words can't, and his voice.
Yes, the glass-shattering scream.
A high-pitched shriek that can literally break glass. His tools of disruption.
I mean, it's a powerful image, this perpetually protesting child. But does Grass really let him off the hook?
Mm-hmm.
Is being a cynical observer enough?
I think that's the brilliance. Grass doesn't provide easy answers. Oscar's perspective gives him this kind of clear sight, seeing the corruption early on. His refusal is his resistance. But the book constantly asks, is that enough? Is withdrawal ever truly innocent?
And that moral complexity is reflected in the people around him.
Absolutely. Look at the core love triangle. There's Agnes, his mother, torn between two worlds, two men.
Representing Danzig's own conflict.
Precisely. Then there's Alfred Matzerath, the German grocer. Oscar's presumed father. He's weak, opportunistic, joins the Nazi party easily.
And the other man.
Jan Bronski, Polish cousin, Agnes's lover. He represents the gentler, perhaps more soulful, but ultimately doomed Polish side of things.
And Oscar doesn't know who his real father is.
Exactly. His own identity is fractured, just like the city. It fuels his outsider status.
So what does he do with that status, with his drum and his voice, as things get darker, as the Nazis rise?
He uses them. The most famous example, maybe, is the Nazi rally. He doesn't throw a bomb. He doesn't shout slogans.
He drums.
He gets underneath the viewing stand and starts drumming, a different beat. He slowly, deliberately turns their rigid marching music into a waltz.
Chaos. undermining their whole performance of power.
It exposes the absurdity, the sort of underlying instability of their ideology, pure artistic disruption.
It's incredibly effective satire.
Yeah.
But these tensions, they have real human costs, don't they? Starting with Agnes.
Oh, Agnes's fate is just devastating. She's crushed by guilt, by her divided loyalties, the secrets. She just unravels.
By her death. It's unforgettable.
It's one of the most grotesque scenes imaginable. She basically forces herself to eat fish, compulsively gorges on them until it kills her.
Perfect.
It's so symbolic. Fish from the Baltic, representing that Danzig world, its lifeblood, she consumes it, is consumed by it. It's like Danzig itself being destroyed by its own internal sickness, its guilt.
Just brutal. And the end of book one forces Oscar into an even more direct confrontation with guilt, doesn't it?
Yes. 1939, the German invasion of Poland. Jan Bronski, the Polish lover, gets trapped defending the Polish post office in Danzig, a famous historical event.
And Oscar's there.
He's nearby, hiding. And in this really chilling moment, a moment of deep ambiguity, he basically encourages Jan to surrender, to give himself up.
Which leads directly to Jan being captured.
And executed by the Germans. Oscar watches it happen.
So Oscar's action, or maybe inaction, or his advice?
Directly leads to death. Was it self-preservation? Panic? Or was it his first real act of complicity with the forces destroying his world? That guilt haunts him forever.
With Jan gone and Agnes dead, he's now solely in the world of Alfred Mazarath, the Nazi sympathizer.
Right. Which transitions us perfectly into book two, The War Years. And here, Oscar's role really shifts. He moves from being this, you know, cynical observer.
To being part of it.
To being a compromised participant. The sidelines aren't safe anymore, or maybe they never were. His protest changes.
How does that happen?
Survival becomes the name of the game, and he finds a mentor of sorts, Babera.
Circus performer. Also a dwarf, like Oscar remains physically.
Yes, Babera is this incredibly cynical, incredibly sharp Jewish performer who understands how the world works, especially in wartime. He sees performance and power as linked.
And he gives Oscar some pretty stark advice.
He does. It's a key quote, really sums up a certain kind of survival strategy. Faber tells him, essentially, always be on the side of the winners, but never be one of them.
Hmm. Stay close to power, benefit from it, but maintain enough distance to avoid the ultimate responsibility.
Exactly. It's deeply amoral. Keep your head down, play the game, survive.
But you could argue it's just a fancy way of justifying collaboration, couldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Moral cowardice dressed up as pragmatism.
Oh, absolutely. And Grass isn't presenting Bebra as a hero. He's showing you the kind of compromises people made, and Oscar listens.
So what does he do?
He joins Bebra's theatrical troupe. They travel, entertain German officers, even near the front lines.
So his art, his drumming, which was once disruptive,
now serves the war machine. It keeps him safe, fed, alive. But it makes him an accomplice. There's no ambiguity now.
But even in this compromised space, there's a flicker of something human.
There is. He has this tender, quite tragic love affair with Roswitha Raguna, an Italian acrobat in the troupe, also a dwarf. A brief connection.
Brief being the operative word, I imagine.
Very brief. She's killed during the Allied landings in Normandy. Just snuffed out. Another casualty of the chaos. Grass allows very little tenderness to survive untouched.
And the war's end in Danzig itself is anything but heroic.
No, it culminates in the death of Alfred Mazarath, Oscar's maybe father. And it's perfectly grotesque.
What happened?
The Soviets are arriving. Panic everywhere. Alfred, the ultimate opportunist, suddenly needs to hide his Nazi affiliation. He has his party pin.
The little badge.
Yes. In his panic, he tries to swallow it. To hide it. He chokes. He literally chokes to death on his Nazi party pin.
Wow. The symbolism. Suffocating on the very thing he embraced for convenience.
It's darkly comic, utterly pathetic, and feels, in the novel's logic, completely deserved. It's like the moral suffocation of the era made horribly literal.
And this moment, Alfred's death, triggers the next huge turning point for Oscar.
Immediately after. At Alfred's funeral, Oscar's son, Kurt, who might also be his half-brother, it's complicated, throws a stone.
Hits Oscar.
Hits him on the head. And the shock, the physical blow, it does something. He stumbles, falls into Alfred's open grave.
And the arrested development reverses.
Violently. His body suddenly, painfully starts growing again. He doesn't become normal, though. He ends up as a hunchback to die.
A hunchback. Bringing us into book three, the post-war era. And that deformity feels significant.
Oh, hugely. It's like the physical manifestation of the burden of guilt and history that Germany and Oscar now carry visibly.
So where does he go? What happens after the war?
He ends up in West Germany, Dusseldorf. part of the Wirtschaftswunder, the economic miracle. Society is booming, rebuilding, and trying very hard to forget the recent past.
Selective amnesia.
Exactly. But Oscar can't forget. His jobs reflect this. First, he works as a stonecutter, engraving tombstones, literally dealing with death and memory. Then he finds unexpected fame as a jazz drummer, playing his tin drum in nightclubs.
The drum again? Still forcing the past into the present?
Relentlessly. While society wants to move on, look forward, Oscar's drumming is this constant rhythmic reminder. Grass has a line paraphrased like, "With my drum, I could call back anything. Drum up the past, drum away the present, drum toward a future."
It's a mnemonic device, a tool against forgetting.
Precisely. It counters the collective amnesia.
And this ties back to the use of the grotesque you mentioned earlier. The fish, the pin, the hunchback.
Yes. Grass uses these jarring, often disgusting images to argue that the reality of the Nazi era and its aftermath was grotesque. It wasn't just bad politics, it was a deep moral and spiritual deformity. The outward absurdity mirrors the inner state.
We also need to remember who's telling us all this. Oscar, from the asylum.
Absolutely crucial. He's the ultimate unreliable narrator, writing his memoirs, shaping his story. He even shifts between writing I and Oscar, first and third person.
Reflecting that fractured self, the disowned memories.
Exactly. And the magical realism, the drum's power, the scream, the non-growing. It's all presented as fact within this very real historical context. It's allegory, suggesting that reality itself became surreal, became nightmarish.
So why is he actually in the asylum? Is he mad?
Not necessarily. It seems more like a chosen sanctuary. He confessed to a murder. He didn't actually commit the murder of a nurse, which happens later in the timeline, but he narrates earlier.
So he puts himself there to escape.
To escape the demands of the world, perhaps. To have the quiet, the isolation, to write his story, to confront his past, or maybe hide from true responsibility. It's ambiguous.
But the ending suggests there's no real escape.
None at all. The book ends as he's about to be released. He's supposedly free. But instead of relief, he's gripped by terror.
He sees something or someone.
He feels pursued by this menacing figure he calls the Black Witch. His final words in the memoir are this panicked question. Who is she? Who is chasing me?
The Black Witch. What does that represent?
It has to be guilt, right? The inescapable past. The moral reckoning that you can't outrun no matter how much time passes or where you go. Leaving the asylum isn't freedom. It's just re-entering the haunted world.
Wow. It leaves you feeling deeply unsettled. It just refuses to give you easy answers about blame or innocence.
It really forces you as a reader into that uncomfortable gray area. You can't neatly label people victims or perpetrators. It's far more tangled.
So the lasting impact. Grass really changed the game for how literature could tackle historical trauma, didn't he?
He showed that real maturity for a person or a nation isn't about claiming innocence, but about facing your complicity, carrying that hunchback of history.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by a Katra Foundation.